Thank you for reading the title. I don't have to read it, so it's wonderful. Again, my name is Sean Bland. I'm a research associate at the Finway Institute, and the project, the presentation I'm going to be presenting, it was a study that was a collaboration between the Finway Institute, the Justice Resource Institute, and the Multicultural AIDS Coalition in Boston, and it was funded by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. I want to start by just acknowledging the presentation collaborators first and foremost, without whom the presentation wouldn't be possible. So just in terms of STD testing among gay and bisexual men, STD testing is a public health concern among men who have sex with men, or MSM, who continue to be the group at greatest risk for HIV and also STDs in the US. It's just important to note that in terms of the research literature, findings suggest that MSM are less likely to be tested for STDs than for HIV. So one study found that 81% of MSM tested in the last year for HIV, but only 61% had tested for an STD. And a study that was recently done from the National HIV Behavioral Surveillance System from 2003 to 2005 found that only one-third had tested for an STD in the past year, so 39% for syphilis and 36% for gonorrhea. Kind of in light of a lot of the recent developments in terms of increases in syphilis and also drug-resistant gonorrhea, research on STD testing is something that's really needed related to MSM. In terms of HIV testing among Black MSM, racial disparities in testing for STDs other than HIV, it hasn't received that much attention. What we do know is that compared to other MSM, Black MSM are tested less frequently for HIV, and they're also less likely to be aware of their HIV infection. But again, less is known about STD testing. Given continuing racial disparities in STD incidence, the study kind of hopes to fulfill a little bit of a gap to kind of at least explore how STD testing is happening among Black MSM in Massachusetts. So again, the objectives was to kind of examine and quantify the frequency of STD testing among an exclusively Black MSM sample in Massachusetts, and then to investigate the association of a variety of factors with having not tested for an STD in the past 2 years prior to study enrollment. And we used kind of a cutoff of 2 years instead of 1 year. I mean, the CDC recommends that gay, bisexual men who have sex with men get tested at least once a year for HIV and for STDs. This is kind of a more conservative estimate, essentially, so men who hadn't been tested in the last 2 years. In terms of the methods of the study, we enrolled 197 participants in 2008, and we used a modified respondent-driven sampling procedure, so it's kind of a snowball sampling procedure in which participants who participated in the study were able to refer and recruit other guys into the study. In terms of eligibility, participants identified as Black, as male, they were at least 18 years of age, they were Massachusetts residents, and reported oral or anal sex with another man in the past year. All the participants went through an informed consent process, and then they were given a survey that was interviewer administered. They also had the option for voluntary HIV counseling and testing, and in terms of compensation, they were compensated for each of those, so for the survey, the testing, and then also for recruiting participants into the study. And the study took place at two community-based organizations in Boston, so the MAC and then the Justice Resource Institute. In terms of measures, we asked questions, a pretty extensive survey battery, so questions on demographics, so age, education, sexual identity, and also health insurance. And then also on sexual risk, so sexual risk behavior, so with male partners, female partners, and also trans partners. We asked about substance use during sex, and then also about STD history and HIV status. Again, the main outcome was kind of looking at STD testing, so whether or not they tested or didn't test in the last 2 years. We also had questions on access to healthcare, so their engagement, having a healthcare provider, having a primary care provider, and then whether or not they were, receiving testing in those kind of different settings. We also had an extensive battery of psychosocial questions. So we asked, we used the Center for Epidemiological Studies depression screener to screen for clinically significant depressive symptoms, and we also used the CAGE questionnaire to screen participants for problematic alcohol use. Again, the primary outcome was not testing for STDs in the past 2 years. We analyzed the data using SAS statistical software and performed bivariate and multivariable logistic regressions. So again, that main outcome, what will strike you most is that the majority, so 60% of the Black MSM in our sample had not been tested for an STD in the past 2 years prior to enrolling in the study. So again, CDC recommendations and also in Massachusetts getting tested within the last year, and we found within the last 2 years that the majority had not been tested for an STD. In terms of just sample demographics, again, this is the entire sample. The mean age of the sample was 38. 87% had a high school degree or GED or less, and 84% were on public health insurance. So we use these kind of as proxies for kind of being of a lower socioeconomic status. Again, although all the participants in the study had engaged in sex with a man in the past year, 55% identified as either heterosexual or bisexual. 20% had never disclosed their MSM sexual behavior to anyone, so not to family, not to friends, or to medical providers. 18% were HIV infected, and again, we confirmed through rapid testing and then had a confirmatory Western blot as well. 29% reported a lifetime history of STDs, and 7% had a diagnosis within the last year. Again, all the participants reported sex with men, and actually 39% had also a female partner within the last year. In terms of their sexual partners, they reported a mean of 6 male partners and 4 female partners in the last year. The majority of the participants did report substance use during sex, most commonly marijuana use, so 39% marijuana, 22% cocaine, and 15% crack. About 30% screened positive for problematic alcohol use on the CAGE questionnaire, so scoring a 3 or 4 on the CAGE, and 33% screened for clinically significant depressive symptoms. In terms of access to healthcare, 81% reported having visited a healthcare provider in the past 12 months. But of that, so although the vast majority were going and engaging in care, only 27% had a healthcare provider actually recommend an STD test during their last visit. 72% had a primary care provider, but again, only 21% had a PCP actually recommend an STD test. So the kind of the gap between those two bars on both sides is really concerning. And just having had the presentation earlier, I think this really kind of gets into kind of quality of care, particularly among communities of color, so among Black men specifically. In terms of characteristics that were associated with STD testing, and then also associated with not, you know, testing for STDs, first, what's kind of working? What seems to be associated with getting tested? So men who were frequently hanging out in MSM venues or hanging out with other MSM were more likely to get tested. Men who visited their healthcare provider in the last year had that provider recommend a test at their last visit. Men who had primary care providers and have a, you know, had a care provider ever recommend an STD test were actually associated with getting tested within the last 2 years prior to study enrollment. In terms of factors associated with not testing, men who were of an older age were less likely to be tested for STDs. So again, that's a concern that I think we definitely need to focus in a little bit more on that population. Although again, in terms of new infections with younger men, we need to see what's working there as well. Men who reported substance use during their last sexual encounter, or their partner had engaged in substance use during their last sexual encounter, were also more likely to not test. History of STDs was associated with not testing, and so this one is a particular concern because it's suggesting that the men who are at greatest risk for STDs may be the ones who aren't actually getting tested. And then also having reporting that you had difficulties using a condom was associated with not testing as well in our bivariate analyses. In our final multivariable model, in which we're reporting relative ratios, we adjusted for age and education, and the following factors remained significant. Having a primary care provider was associated with a kind of a decreased odds of not getting tested. So essentially, in another, framing that in a different way, if you had a if you were tested for STDs in the last 2 years, those participants, over 70%, had a PCP. Of the men who had not been tested, only just over 50% had a PCP. So there's something about being engaged in care that's leading to more likelihood of being tested. The same is true for having that PCP recommend an STD test. Of those who were tested, 40% almost had that PCP recommend a test to them. Of the men who had not been tested, again, that's the majority, only 10% had a PCP actually initiate or recommend a test in their lifetime. The same is true for just the primary care provider visits in the last year, and then also having that primary care provider recommend a test during the last visit. And again, these were all significant after controlling for kind of just demographic factors. So just in terms of conclusions, lack of STD testing seems to represent a public health concern, specifically among Black MSM in Massachusetts. 60% of this sample had not been tested for STDs in the prior 2 years. in terms of the take-homes, Black MSM, who seemed to be at the highest risk, so those who had a history of STDs, who were using substances during sex, were seeming to not be regularly testing for STDs. Integration into health services and to health and with healthcare providers may be an important role for important in terms of promoting STD testing among Black MSM. In terms of implications, interventions that promote access to timely and also culturally competent and high quality STD testing and treatment services are needed. Provider training may also be warranted to educate providers about the specific health needs of Black MSM. In terms of limitations, the data were cross-sectional, so we can't say anything about causality. Also, recruitment biases may have limited generalizability. In terms of the strength, this study does extend prior research, so it examines STD testing among an exclusively Black MSM sample in Massachusetts. In terms of future investigations, again, I think other presenters have talked about other factors, really needing to focus in on those, psychological stressors, racism, homophobia, discrimination, or other factors that may affect STD testing. We need also kind of larger studies as well, larger longitudinal studies, things like HPTN, so HIV Prevention Trials Network, 061, which is a six-site study that's being rolled out in actually one of the sites is Boston, and kind of the goal of that study is to focusing on Black, gay, and bisexual men, getting them tested for HIV, also for STDs, getting them engaged in care, and also providing them with like health navigation to kind of keep them engaged and connected to care. So those types of studies and kind of programming may be something that's particularly useful in terms of increasing from the 60% who's kind of essentially they're falling through the cracks. Also, it's useful to investigate the effectiveness of other strategies, things like universal testing in accordance with CDC recommendations among this population. I think that it's definitely something that we've talked about a lot in Massachusetts, and one of the great things is in our state and a few other states out there, with universal healthcare, having healthcare to 90% or more of the population, it's, Black MSM are able to actually engage in care, and so getting routine testing is useful. One of my concerns is that sometimes people who are not really, who don't have health insurance or who are not regularly attending, and this may be a lot of, kind of younger MSM as well, universal testing may not be the best option, but it's definitely something to continue to consider. Again, thank you for your attention, and I guess we're gonna have questions.
Thanks to all of our presenters this morning. We're actually doing pretty well on time. We're at 11:55 now, so we have about 15 minutes to have a question and answer session for our speakers this morning. If I can have all the speakers kind of come up to the front, that will be helpful. And what we'll do is go ahead and take you all's questions. I'm trying to see, it may be easier to come up here because then people can kind of see you. And I'll take this off. Okay, so if you all have a question, I'd ask you to please raise your hand and I will. Okay, gentleman right here.
I want to first thank all the speakers. There was some amazing information presented. I also heard, and I considered a lot of things that didn't come from each of your presentations, but I'm wondering, this may take a whole 15 minutes, but could share something that they found that surprised them in your research, something that is new and definitely needs further investigation.
Okay. You want to start? No. Anybody want to talk about something that surprised them in their?
Very briefly, one of the things that surprised the team about the house project was that there's a perception that within the ball culture that when people are competing, that it also kind of sets the environment for violence to occur. And even though within the balls, it's more often than people care to talk about that a fight kind of breaks out during a ball event, one thing that became very clear during the focus groups is that that's not really what the community wanted. I mean, that was like an outcome that for whatever reason couldn't be helped, but it was one of the key things that they wanted to change. They really wanted to have more cohesion within the community, and they also really wanted to do more, not just within their own house, but also between houses. So that was, I think, not so much a surprise for us, but a surprise for the community members who participated in our study.
Anybody else? Okay, everybody else?
I have a question, maybe for Mark, because what I Well, I think your comment is a good one in that there are so many different variables that come into play. And just as you were talking, I was thinking beyond that, and I was thinking, okay, when you look at individual variables, what variables are behind those? And it occurred to me that it would be very easy with any one of those studies if someone were to just look at a variable unit, just one versus another, say, let's say, age of, you could look at many variables, look at one versus another, and you might find an association, but that doesn't tell the whole story. You have to look beyond that at the individual and even in groups and at the multiple risk factors at play. So we have to be careful not to say label a certain age parent or a certain, certain category. We don't want to label that all of those such will be at risk, but then you want to look at, okay, so if the parent is this age, and then what are these other variables that are protective and supportive? And so, yes, I mean, it's a great question and it's a great comment. Right, exactly. I mean, that's perfect, and that's exactly what we have to do is just look at each variable in detail. And we have to think creatively because there are probably some aspects of this that have not been studied well yet. So thank you. That's exactly the kind of questions we need to be asking.
Do you know what the red sweater is?
Just in terms of this study took place in 2008, so the beginning part of that year. I'm not 100%, I'm kind of new to Massachusetts, so I'm not 100% sure about when the universal kind of healthcare legislation was being phased in. I'm sure at that time, I believe that it was still in the process of really kind of getting people enrolled into MassHealth and to other forms of state-sponsored health insurance. Nowadays, when we do our research projects, I say 95% of our participants have healthcare insurance, so that's like that's a wonderful thing. And so I think that's kind of the change that's been happening over time. In terms of just some of the economic kind of factors that's been affecting Massachusetts, that's been affecting I think states across the country. I know that essentially all of the STD clinics have been like defunded by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And in Massachusetts, there are some that are still running, I believe at MGH and also at Boston University Medical Center, that are either funded through other grants, not from the state, or you know they're using their own funds to keep those services going. It's definitely a huge concern. I've been really excited about this recent study of HBTN 061. That's taking place in six sites, Boston, New York, Atlanta, DC, I believe San Francisco, and LA, and Fenway is one of the sites in Boston. And it's a study that's doing some really great things. They're trying to recruit, I think, about 1,000 black, gay, bisexual women who have sex with men into the study, get them tested, get them for STDs, HIV, knowing their status. I think programs like that, really engaging people, keeping them in care, having navigation will be really instrumental. And also kind of reaching out to try to get people in non-traditional locations. So I know some really wonderful work being done in at least Boston and Massachusetts by the Department of Public Health and by one of their consultants and collaborators, Catherine O'Connor, who's a professor at Northeastern. She goes to sex parties, she goes to cultural events, she goes to other places where to get guys tested, and she does testing at those events for HIV, for STDs. And so I think it's really great in terms of reaching out to communities of color, particularly men who, I mean, I just know that there's lots of men who don't want to come to Fenway necessarily to get tested because it's too gay identified, and particularly a lot of black men. So I think kind of going out and doing that and providing services, again, you need funds for it, and hopefully things can change, like, you know, programs continue to be funded. But I think it's a great question, and hopefully we can talk more.
I think, like, your presentation, my question about the house culture, one, it seems like they could have some real benefits in terms of prevention, and also some real risk in terms of transmission. I'm wondering if you studied the network structure at all of when people were reporting having sex with other members, and have you seen any outbreaks of STDs and so
Okay, you cheated. Yeah, those are like three questions, and I hope I remember them. Right. With regard to mobilization, there actually is some kind of intra-interventions that are implemented. And I don't want to, maybe implemented is a strong word, but that the community has actually mobilized around HIV/AIDS. I mean, and part of it is because they're so impacted by HIV/AIDS, particularly the House Ball members who are older in the community. And when I say older, I mean like 25 and older. I mean like 30 or 40 or older. I mean, so that's one thing. And that was one of the great things about the movie, How Do I Look? Because it was a significant part of that movie that talked about the work that is done around the MSM community, but not enough that's done within the house community, because the expectation is that they're a very small community. With regard to sex, it's interesting. One of the things that came out during the focus groups was that every house has its own milieu, and that there are some houses that are very focused on making sure that their members are educated, that they're making sure that their members have other opportunities. For example, the House of Blahnik, where Damon Hughes, he had this MPH, he's working on his PhD, and he actually has links to CDC links. And so he encourages his members of his house to do testing, not just HIV testing, but also STD testing. So a house like that would be great to partner with prevention. And then there are other houses, which I won't name, you know, because it then becomes stigmatizing, that have more of the reputation of being more violent, where the mothers and the father, almost like incestuous, if you will, types of relationship within the houses, where they're more known for having sex within the house itself. And that some of the members actually being initiated into the house per having sex with some of the leaders of the house. So it really depends on the house itself. But I think the key thing is that the overall house structure, not just the microstructure of the houses, but the macrostructure of the houses themselves, really can be utilized to disseminate interventions, and also to support more homegrown interventions. And some of the work, some of that type of work actually has been done in DHAB. In DSTD and other venues may not have done it as much, but it's a great opportunity to kind of carry the message of STD prevention above and beyond HIV prevention. Right. Okay.
This question is for Dr. Smith. I noticed that you asked about your sex in 6 months or 12 months. I'm wondering if you would be the energy in between your current partners, your partners, particularly in the relationship between African American women, can they have more current partners that can be multiple at the same time and not sequential, where like might remain in the relationship and start another relationship, and transmission and risks are different between those two.
Right, we did have a specific question on concurrent partners in terms of currently did they know if their partner was having a sexual relationship with another woman also, if they were in a committed relationship. It didn't come out by itself. The only time that it did show up as significant was with the risky partner variable, where in risky partner was defined by a partner who had an STD, used injection drugs, was recently released from jail, or had a concurrent partner. So when it was combined with those four, it did come out, but not on its own. We only had significance for multiple partners.
Christy. When you model the individual and
the equivalent?
Yeah. Right, the equivalent. Did you put those in the same model?
Yeah.
Okay, well, did you think about collinearity? Because they wouldn't they somewhat be correlated to
They're definitely correlated, but they actually weren't so correlated that it gave us issues with collinearity in the model. That was, you asked about what was surprising. That was one of my concerns, was that if they were so incredibly related that, you know, you couldn't separate them at all. But in fact, there were, if you look at like the 2x2 table, individual level SES by zip code level SES, there were, you know, a fair number of adolescents in each of those cells. So it doesn't mean that everyone with low individual SES lived in a poor area, and it doesn't mean that everyone who lived in a poor area had low SES. So I did look at that.
I think you had a question right there.
And this question is also for Christy. In your study, what were the different natural groups, and also within the groups, what were the differences that you saw in economic status and also in sexual behavior?
I'm sorry, I missed the key word. The what groups?
Latino, Hispanic.
I had not looked at that, partly because the number of Latinos was relatively small. So what I ended up doing was to actually combine. I did had minority, which was Black and or Latino versus Caucasian, but I certainly understand that there are differences there, and collapsing might not be the best choice. I think it was more in terms of numbers, though. But it's a good, write that down, Rachel.
we'll do the last three. We have you, and then we have you, and then we have you.
Yeah, this is for Samantha, so calling about the health policy committee. And the question is, what if you know the answer, what is the degree of overlap between the transgender community, let's say the Black transgender community, and the house ball community? So, like, what is the percentage of, say, transgenders who may take some connection to one house? Do you have any idea?
In South Carolina, we don't, and to be quite honest, we really don't anywhere else. Within the sample that we have, everyone who was transgender was a member of the house. And even then, we have very small numbers of transgendered persons who have completely made their M to F transition. But we did have 20% who actually were in a process of making that transition. And from the focus groups, and Dr. White can talk a little bit more about this, that it was sort of like suggested that being a member of a house, especially in South Carolina, especially in some of the rural, more rural, I mean, I look at Columbia and think it's rural, and they're like, no, honey, that's the big city. I mean, but in some of the more rural areas, that being a member of the house actually helps facilitate that transition.
Just briefly, one of the things that we didn't talk about was that very often individuals are recruited into houses based on what they can bring to the houses. And therefore, individuals, their categories of how they walk in a ball of realness or vogue femme or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are very often individuals, such as transgenders or individuals who are transgendering, who become vital parts and components of the house, of individual houses. And although, back to what Dr. Williams said, I don't think there's a good estimate of the relationship, it does exist.
This is a kind of continuation of the question to Dr. Saffron. Intuitively, it feels like any adolescent, even to themselves, would not admit that their caregiver cared a lot for them. So I'm not surprised that the 86% who said that they cared a lot. To me, finding proxy questions, extensive proxy questions, to actually try to cover this sense of caring, in other words, without actually using the does your mother care for you? Of course she does.
I agree with that. That's a very good point. And it's true. This was just, we were looking at one question, and really the same caveat that I give to every study is that obviously you'd want to look, we would want to be able to look beyond that and what was behind that response and, what was behind the response for the people that didn't respond that way and to be able to look in a more sophisticated way.
And also the language. If you could have focus groups with kids saying how they would describe their relationship to their caregivers so that you then can use their words for what is caring and what is not caring.
Oh, sure. Now, these things need to be looked at. This is meant to point toward need for further research. Another point that you didn't make, but I was hoping somebody would, was that just because the adolescent believes that the relationship isn't a good one, or that it's not supportive, the mother doesn't care, that doesn't necessarily mean that the mother really doesn't care. There are two to that relationship, so it would be interesting to see the other side of what was there.
Go ahead. I have a response to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, and also, the other thing is there could have just been, an argument the day before this was asked about maybe something even related to choice of sexual partners or something like that. So, there's a lot more below the surface. This was just the beginning. Hopefully, lots more research to come.
Okay, I have to respond to that. Because in Albany, we are getting ready to do a study that is on exactly what you talked about. And we are going to be interviewing adolescents who are coming through the probation system and their mothers. So we're pairing the kids and their mothers. and asking a huge number of questions because we're doing it on PDAs. They go really fast. We can get through a lot more questions than we would otherwise. And so thinking about lots of different ways to ask about closeness, about communication, about household rules, about, I mean, there's just like a bunch of different questions and sort of more extensive outcomes. So I'm very interested in what we're gonna see in terms of what the kids say about their perception of the relationship, and how does that match with what the mother says about their perception of the relationship, and what is it that matters? Is it what the kid thinks? Is it what the mother does? Or is it about what the perception is? And the same thing also in terms of behaviors. If the kid is having sex, and the mother, does the mother perceive that the kid is having sex? And like, how does that affect the outcomes as well? So if anybody has any suggestions about questions that we should ask, I'm like, I'm full in questionnaire development stage, so we need to talk.
And I'll ask a question.
Okay, and I think my last question didn't take 15 minutes, so maybe this will hold me. I'm wondering, Dr. Sackler, also, I think the family's in a bit of trouble in this country across all communities, actually. We're not family strong, thank you, my humble opinion. I'm wondering why, though, I see a lot of young African-American men who are involved with their children, including lower SES communities. I'm wondering if you also asked, or if some of the young women said how important their fathers were, and if not, why that question wasn't asked, because again, there are a lot of young guys very much involved with their children, in spite of what the media and everybody else tells us about black men.
That's a very good point. I actually had, I don't know if anyone noticed, but when I put in the, we put in the slide about the caregiver in the beginning that we were showing the relationship between children and a caregiver, and put in a male caregiver just to kind of remind me that that's an important issue. In this particular sample, if the primary, it was based on who the primary caregiver was. So if the primary, and remember these were asked face to face, so if the primary caregiver was not the mother, in most cases in this sample the primary caregiver was the mother, but if the primary caregiver was not, then the adolescent would have been asked about whoever the primary caregiver was, could have been a father or an aunt or, you know, whoever else it was. But that's a very good point. Whoever the primary caregiver is, whether it's the father or another relative who's taken on the primary responsibility, that we want to honor that person and support that person. They're important to the relationship. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm glad.
All right, well, can we give our